6.5% was it? Is that what the current odds are of the Stanley Cup?
Well, and if you look at the round by round progression, the Stanley Cup favorite is the Vancouver Canucks.
Like, what a time to be alive!
Talking you through every goalie controversy, scoring slump, and draft lottery bust, this is the C4 Podcast on CanucksHockeyBlog.com. Here they are, the best starting lineup we could afford under the salary cap. Chris, Matt, Anna, and Adam.
Welcome to another episode of the C4 Canucks Hockey Podcast, brought to you by the Full Press Coverage Network and CanucksHockeyBlog.com. I am Chris at Lifeforce, joined virtually as always by the most consistent podcaster this side of the Smelosphere, and Anna Forsyth, A Forsyth03. I just tried to say Anna Swore.
Okay. I mean, I do often, but not on the show, but it's fine. You've only been introducing me for 4 odd years.
Yeah, like, that's a stumble. I mean, if I was a professional podcaster, we would start over, or I would look for a way to edit that out. But I am not a professional podcaster, just the longest term Canucks podcaster and running. We got, 2 months on Pucks on Net? But we are joined by a phenomenal guest in John Jang, formerly of Sportsnet 650, for those that might be looking for street credit, but now you're over at NW, I believe, right?
Yeah, that's correct. Happy to be here, by the way. I really appreciate the invitation. Always fun to talk a little Canucks. And people are wondering where I've been or what I'm doing, I'm currently an on-air contributor and host at 980 CKNW right here in Vancouver. So I didn't go very far, still in town, and now not so much sports talk, but more news and current events. But always having a lot of fun.
Well, again, thank you for joining us. I remember when you joined Sportsnet 650 and you were paired with Satir Shah, friend of the show, Sat Shah. He and you had some really good chemistry, and I actually really enjoyed that segment. So obviously, it was a shame that it eventually had to be or was broken up. But regardless, if there's one thing that I know of you, you provide some of the most intelligent Canucks takes, which, having been on the Smelosphere as long as I have, are few and far between from many. So it's good to have someone who knows what they're talking about on the show.
Well, thank you. That's the nicest thing anyone's ever said about me and my Canucks takes. I will send you that $20. It'll come in the mail there for you. No, it was a lot of fun working with Sat. And, he provided a lot of the in-depth analysis and great, observations. And I would just sort of come in there with the Kevin Bieksa gunslinging type hot takes just to see what would happen. And more often than not, kind of landed me in a little bit of trouble, but always fun. And I hope that was the big thing that people took away from that show.
Yeah. There was, I want to say it was Dave Pratt that once said it, but I mean, there's a number of different broadcasters that we've had in Vancouver, but someone had said, love me, hate me, just listen to me. And, when it comes down to carrying on the conversation, I was a love you fan, even though I didn't necessarily always agree with them. You delivered them in an intelligent fashion, and I couldn't be upset about it.
Yeah. So, and yes. I think that's a really good way of putting it. The last thing anyone wants is for people to be apathetic to what you're doing. That's like the worst case scenario, when you know that even if you throw out an outrageous take, there's just nothing happening for responses because people have tuned out. You've lost whatever trust and faith from people. And so that's no man's land or no person's land, really. And certainly we don't want that. So I will throw in as many hot takes here in this episode as I can. And I'm sure we'll get some fired responses. Yeah.
Hey, I mean, they can't be any hotter than half the takes Anna and I spit out on a weekly basis.
I'll try and keep up.
Yeah. But we're going to get into the week that was for the Vancouver Canucks, everything that seems to be going on. The fact that Pettersson is still out, is that a reason for concern? We've got the week ahead because the Canucks are out east for another one of these Eastern swing road trips. We also thought we'd start to spin yarn about restricted free agents, because it only became apparent to me, having had a nice, pleasant 24-hour long conversation with Caleb on Twitter, that there are some contracts up in the air. And then based on that conversation, we're going to talk about whether or not this is the darkest tenure in Vancouver Canucks history. Before we do move into Rewind, though, I do have to ask you, John, do you know about Caleb at Stuff Caleb Said?
Ooh, that sounds familiar. There's so many great different accounts on Twitter. It's hard to keep track of each and every different one. But remind me, what made Caleb stand
great.
Out here?
Yeah. Tell us what's great about Caleb, Chris.
Well, okay. Stuff Caleb Said is a very prolific Benning supporter who's very high on the Vancouver Canucks. And there's nothing wrong with being a positive fan or supporting a particular GM. I think for those listeners of our podcast, I've not been a Benning supporter since day one. I was the Lawrence Gilman guy, and I've just held a grudge, as Vancouver Canucks fans are apt to do. But I got into a conversation with him, and I had my credibility called into question because it's obvious that I don't know a thing about the Vancouver Canucks and only just started watching. But as far as sort of history goes, this Twitter account shared a preseason sort of prediction post in a screen capture based on something written, I think, in Notepad. And the desktop had like some real interesting folder names. The browser tabs that were open up equally as interesting. Like there was a folder about letters to the CRTC complaining about, and then like dot, dot, dot. Like it was, it came across as parody, but then the person followed it up by accusing, I think it was like JPAD of sharing their personal information. So I guess point I'm trying to get at is there's some questions. Is it a parody account, of which there's many in Canucks Twitter?
Right.
Or is it actually a person? And I sort of go with the presumption that it's a person because I would never want to do anyone a disservice by thinking they are a parody unless that's their intent. But yeah, I had a nice long conversation with either a real person or a parody, but either way, I'm owning it.
It happens to the best of us if it ends up being a parody account. Can't say I've had too many interactions with this particular account, but certainly I've had interactions with people who also question my credibility. And I worked in sports radio for over 2 years. So it happens to everyone. That's really when you know you've made it.
That's right. Well, then, geez, Anna, hear that? John just said, we've made it.
Oh, God. Don't inflate his ego.
Looking back at the week that was, the Vancouver Canucks, going into tonight's game against the Senators, had won a game and had lost a game. Now, the Vancouver Canucks had a winning streak when we last spoke, and the thought was that for some reason or another, the team had figured out that their problem all along had been Elias Pettersson. Apparently, having him in the lineup prevented them from generating offense, playing defensively sound hockey, impacted their goaltender's ability to stand on their head, board up the net, and stop about 60 shots a game. And then they got brought back down to earth when Montreal decided to explain to them that we are the better of the two teams, because, again, Montreal has the number. So, sure enough, leave it to the Ottawa Senators to go and say, hey, Vancouver, we know we need to help you out here. Let's spot you a couple of points, albeit through bonus hockey, because the Vancouver Canucks had a lead that they ultimately blew. And that's, again, what happens when you allow your goaltender to have to face 60-some-odd shots. I mean, I'm exaggerating. It was like 42. But like the Vancouver Canucks, I think, in this game alone, blocked like 30-some-odd. So when we consider the Canucks at this point, and I'm going to share sort of a comment that JJ Guerrero, blog father, guy who started up Canucks Hockey Blog, at Canucks Hockey on Twitter said, and I'm paraphrasing his tweet. When we were talking about this, and he said we, it's fans, that we were talking the Vancouver Canucks to make the playoffs would need to play 650 hockey go forward. Since that conversation to now, the Canucks are at 750. So is this a playoff team? Is this a team that suddenly figured out everything that was wrong and solved those problems? And despite not having their best player in Pettersson in the lineup, who, when he comes back, will just bring this team into the Stanley Cup contention? Like, what's going on, John?
Yeah, it's a bizarre thing, right? You're losing your best player. Status really still remains a mystery as to what is going on with his health and when he'll be back. But somehow, inexplicably, illogically, the Canucks are 5-1 without Elias Pettersson. So maybe you're right. Maybe he was the problem all along. Maybe this is actually a big facade and he's not that good of a player. No, obviously joking. He represents the best and brightest for the Canucks in terms of looking ahead to the future. But it is perplexing as to how this happened. The only reasonable explanation that comes to mind is that maybe when you feel like as a team, you don't have your ace in your pocket right now, you do everything possible to scratch, claw, and fight tooth and nail to get some of those points because you need something. You need some sort of spark or hope. And although the recipe doesn't always seemingly turn out, in the case of the Ottawa Senators outshooting the Canucks heavily, driving play basically all throughout the entire game and needing Thatcher Demko to put on an incredible performance just to get you to overtime and then eventually winning the game, they're doing it. And I think you gotta just sort of sit back and kind of give them a golf clap saying, okay, I don't really understand how this is working, but it's working. It's like an old jalopy of a machine where your car isn't really supposed to go any further, but it gives you that extra 20 kilometers every night. And you have no idea how it ends up happening that way.
I think John is dead on there in the jalopy metaphor, because eventually those cars sputter out and, you know, you can only run on fumes / Thatcher Demko for so long, right? And even with Thatcher Demko stepping up, do we get these wins without, you know, Brock Besser finding his form again, without Bo Horvat playing the way that he is? Probably not. So we've just about made it over the hill, over this slump. But either Pettersson comes back soon or Canucks do something to help out their goaltender, because it's not sustainable.
Well, I don't necessarily disagree in sustainability. I would be the last person to suggest what the Vancouver Canucks are doing are indicative of a team who are bound to make the playoffs or give a serious run, especially with Pettersson out of the lineup. And I would not argue against the fact that the Canucks are equivalent to that old jalopy that's just getting you from sort of gas station to gas station, destination to destination. At some point, will fall apart, won't start, the engine doesn't turn over, it runs out of gas, or all of the above. But what we're seeing from the Canucks through this sort of extreme level of adversity right now often encourages a team to do superhero-like activity when things do turn around. Like when Pettersson does come back and they've learned how they can, you know, buckle down, block shots, have a goaltender who stops every puck thrown at him, like all of these things happening and clicking at once. And then they think, oh, something or anything, it's possible. That's the scary part. It's I'm not trying to say the Canucks making the playoffs is scary. Well, maybe I am, but it almost hides all of the problems that I think were quite apparent and quite clear to us prior to this more recent run. Like defensively, the Vancouver Canucks are hurting. I mean, their game plan is rely on a goaltender who bails you out of more problems than you can imagine and try to score enough goals that your goaltender doesn't, you know, like tonight's a good example. There was that one goal that gave the Sens thought, and then all it took was maybe a mistake by Demko throwing it up the boards as he did, where you know a puck will get passed. So it's again, just a weird space to watch the Canucks sit.
Yeah, it's interesting because, I mean, this could have easily gone the other way. I mean, Brady Tkachuk rang one off the crossbar, and if that ends up being a goal, Senators probably tighten up, sit back, and try to play a lot more defensively as opposed to opening things up and allowing for a bit more of an aggressive forecheck. But it's really bizarre, again, how this team is managing to perform. In terms of like the team letting in as many shots as they do, well, that's a consistent theme. Like that seems to happen. You look to the beginning of the season, and you even look last year in the playoffs in the bubble. Thatcher Demko needed to be sensational, and Jacob Markstrom as well, in order for the Canucks to have gone as far as they did. And that formula didn't really change. And I guess a lot of people aren't too surprised by that. You lose a lot of the veteran experience that a guy like Chris Tanev brought to the lineup in the offseason. And now, you know, however many games the Canucks are in at this point, that hasn't changed. It's still just, oh boy, hang on, grab your helmet because it's going to be a rough night out. What is telling to me, though, is that the Canucks are changing their style of forecheck. And by that, I look at the Tanner Pearson goal. against the Senators, where, like, first of all, I buy totally into the notion that he did call for the pass from Colin White and duped him. It's a good veteran play. Reminded me of, like, the old Ryan Kessler stick
I was
tap.
About to say, yeah.
Yeah, and I had shades of Kess 17 doing that same sort of thing. And honestly, it used to work for Kess. If it works for Pearson, that's a good savvy veteran move. But that play, that goal, was a result of the Canucks changing their forecheck a little bit now. So you have two forwards going in deep behind the goal line when it's applicable to do so, when the puck is behind the goal line. And you've got two guys in there battling for that loose puck. And you've got the third forward near the hash marks up high. You keep them there passively because you're trying to see if you can intercept a breakout pass, which is what Colin White thought he was enabling. Or in the rare event that you actually get that pass to Tanner Pearson right on his stick and then you shoot it right in. But that forecheck doesn't usually look like that if Pettersson's in the lineup. Like when the Canucks are fully healthy, they have one forward in deep and they have two forwards sort of out wide just to try and control the zone a little bit. Because the one thing that eludes the Canucks even sometimes on the power play is sustained zone pressure. So maybe this is maybe we have to give Travis Green a little bit more credit here. Even without Elias Pettersson, he has managed to find a specific tactic that is getting the best out of this team right now. And again, 5-1 without your best player speaks volumes on something. I can't quite put my finger on what that is, but it's working.
Yeah. Well, go ahead, Anna.
I was just going to say that I agree that praise is due to Travis in his adaptability. And I mean, you could say that all along working with the roster that he's been working with. And even defense, even though the number of shots that Demko is facing is not at all reducing, we are getting better at like forcing the lower quality shots, forcing the shots to the outside, which the Canucks did in the playoffs when Demko was forced into the starter role there. So if we give, we have to give some credit there. It's not a huge compliment, but some credit.
The sort of follow-up to that is, as Anna mentioned, applauding maybe Green's adaptability, presuming this is a coaching decision that's been made as to adjusting the forecheck. When Petey comes back to the lineup, which may happen eventually, we'll talk more about Petey in a moment. Do you believe Green continues to use what now is working and find a way to have PD work within that? Or do they go back to the style of play that Pettersson would have come out of, the old way that wasn't working?
I think Travis Green goes back to what has been his sort of forte. And while he, when forced and under these particular circumstances, he'll change because he has to. History has shown that he likes to roll with what he knows and he likes to roll with what his best players are comfortable with. Mm-hmm. And, again, let's not kid ourselves. Pettersson is the best player on this team by a long shot. It's great to see Besser has been more productive this year. He looks healthy. He looks good. It's also great to see Quinn Hughes has been, producing at a fair point as well. But Pettersson, this team goes as far as Elias Pettersson is going to carry them. So, once he's ready to come back, I think Travis Green doesn't really have an option. Like, you just have to work with what works for Petey and his line. And if that's putting him back on with Miller and whoever else, really, that third player to me is not so important these days. I know Besser's been looking real good. That's what I think Travis Green would end up doing.
I completely agree. I mean, to go off the rails slightly, one criticism of Messi, maybe the greatest player to ever play football, is that if you have him on your team, you have to shape a team around him, but you do it because it's Messi. And the benefits you get from that is ginormous. And Pettersson isn't the best player of our time, but he's definitely the best player on the team. So yeah, whatever works best for him, I think is a situation you go with.
I could say, what happens though when Messi is Messi instead of Messi being Messi?
Don't laugh at that, John. Like, it was an awful dad joke.
The one thing about me is that I love those kinds of jokes. So it's right up my forte. I'm not even a dad. I'm just in training right now, I guess.
So Pettersson's out. I mean, we've talked about this last week when it sort of happened. It happened in a practice. And we had sort of joked that, just like Jim's plan, Petey is out day to day. Well, a week has now gone by. Pettersson is remaining out of the lineup and has not made this road trip east. One might suggest there is a way to get him out there, but the complexity of travel within the pandemic and then to enter into an NHL lineup is so significant that the likelihood is Pettersson is now beyond day to day and is now maybe week to week. Any idea what happened? Like, is this, do you think, the result of maybe a series of injuries that maybe got uncovered based on something that happened in a practice Inaki took, and now the team's just being patient in his recovery? Or do you think there's more to this where there's a bigger problem, and as a result, the Vancouver Canucks are just being very, you know, non-specific in their description because they don't want to discourage us fans or let onto the competition the long-term plan?
I mean, I don't want to speculate too much because they've been trying to keep this under wraps. I haven't personally heard anything. I'm not in communication with a lot of the those guys anymore. However, I actually don't mind if they're taking their time and making sure that he's not 100% ready. He's 110% ready. Again, this is your franchise player. You have to go and make sure that like he's in the best shape of his life. I'm paraphrasing and I'm exaggerating a little bit, but how many times in the Canucks, you know, in recent years has a player come back too early and that has only aggravated something that was lingering or has led to a completely different injury? And again, the best example is Brock Besser. The amount of injuries that he's had to face over the past number of years, we knew that he was playing uncomfortably, right? In 2019, we knew that he was not 100% in 2018, but the Canucks didn't really, I guess, have the patience to make sure that he was going to be 100%. They needed to win games. They wanted to get into the playoffs. Besser ends up coming back, never looks quite comfortable, at least not 100%, and actually re-aggravates some of those injuries. Now he's finally healthy, and you're seeing what a productive Brock Besser does for your team. I'm approaching Pettersson completely differently if I'm the Canucks. I say, okay, this guy, obviously we know he's an incredibly hot, talented hockey player. We can't jeopardize this. Based on where we are, and I'm saying as the Canucks, based on where this team is in the standings, it's not really like you're in a pressing situation. I'll explain that a little bit because I know obviously the playoff picture is still there. But if you are Jim Benning and you spoke with media quite recently and you said, well, our window to win is probably 2 years from now, great. Then go by that timeline and don't jeopardize the health of your best player because you want to win games right here today. Do what's best for Pettersson. Let him feel 200%, then get him back. That way you'll have no concerns that he's going to, you know, tweak something all over again, or he's going to be playing timid and afraid or something like that. Just make sure he's okay.
And I, just to qualify what I'm suggesting, I'm not suggesting rush him back. I'm not too concerned about PD coming back. Arguably, the Vancouver Canucks are playing some pretty solid hockey right now without him. So there isn't this pressing need to get him in the lineup to try to make that late season playoff run. On that note, the Vancouver Canucks are still below 500 and have games in hand against all the teams they're chasing, so it doesn't help their own cause that they've dug such a deep hole. It's just the thought being of, as we've seen from the Vancouver Canucks historically, is these players are returning a little bit maybe premature or maybe pushing themselves too hard to get back into the lineup, and then in turn re-aggravation, re-injury. Obviously, the last thing we or any Canucks fan wants is Pettersson to come back and then suffer from that next season, or in the hypothetical sense and that crazy opportunity the Vancouver Canucks have at making the playoffs this season. I can't see this existing team go on a run without him.
No, I agree. But yes, and agree with both that no way that he should be rush back. I think this injury has given us as Canucks fans and the sort of media landscape to analyze the frustrating thing of hockey injuries in general and how teams talk about them because of the change from day to day. Oh, he's going to be out a week. Oh, it's going to be more like 10 days. He's not going on the road trip. And yes, things change all the time. You never know what's happening with injuries, but just the determination of the hockey world at large to be as obscure and vague as possible about injuries. It's just very frustrating. If they were more upfront about things, there wouldn't be people getting frustrated because they'd be more transparent about the whole thing. but that's a larger issue and not really specific to the Canucks or Patterson. They're not alone in talking about injuries this way.
Yeah, and I feel like that's just another unique disadvantage of what this COVID-19 reality has done. You can't have reporters, you know, having even off the record conversations with players because they're not in the building, they're not in the locker room, and all you can do post game is do the Zoom chat. You get two questions in, that's it. So there's really not ever a ton of wiggle room where somebody like Drancer or J-Pat or anyone else would be able to fire some of these questions or find somebody separately and just be like, hey, off the record, because I'm curious myself what's going on behind the scenes. And sometimes players are willing to at least say a few things if you assure them that this isn't going to air, to at least calm people's nerves a little bit.
A little off the rails, though, but to segue, in the NFL, you pretty much know right down to the toe that has the ingrown nail that's keeping a particular player out. And by the way, they ate Captain Crunch for breakfast this morning. And then you have the NHL, where the extreme examples are the Alain Vigneault description of he has a body injury, which frankly is better than the auto body injury that potentially could. Like, do you ever see the NHL getting to that prescriptive level that a league like the NFL has? And I use NFL as an example because it's the North American sort of sports standard with information. But we get this type of detail out of baseball, soccer, or what Anna would properly call football, similar levels of sort of injury information, maybe not as descriptive as NFL, but like when a player is out, you kind of have an idea why. Like they're telling you, oh, it's a hamstring, quad, a rotator, like whatever it might be. And they give you a timeline. NHL, it's like day to day, week to week, upper or lower. Like unless it's obvious where they say lower body injury and you watch them walk by with a walking cast. And that's not the team telling you that. That's your eye saying, well, okay, it's the left leg. And I think this is what's happening based on what I saw. Like, again, it's like you're having to string everything together. But do you ever see that changing in the NHL?
I do. I think the NFL, I do agree. I think they do a great job just being transparent with what's happening with their players. And when teams aren't fully honest with their weekly status updates throughout the, you know, Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, et cetera, those teams actually can get fined because you have to be completely honest. And we've seen that happen in recent seasons with various teams. I think the NHL will get there because they recently signed, you know, deals to make sure that sports betting in the NHL is going to be a thing. We know that they're going to slow roll it. They're going to take their time. The game is conservative by nature. And I think the players and probably the players' union don't necessarily want some of those details going out. However, if you are now dealing with potentially a multi-billion dollar enterprise with sports gambling and betting, those odds makers are going to want to know. And they have a lot of leverage because of the money that's associated with that. So I do think we're going to get there. I would love to see what the NFL does where, you know, the practice before a game, they have to issue like a game day or sorry, practice report, like who practiced, who didn't practice, why, was it because it was just a rest day or is there an actual injury that's related to the reason why they couldn't practice? I would love to see that because, again, it takes care of reporters having to ask these questions all the time, which they don't really want to do. They'd rather be asking more pressing questions. And also for the fan base at large, like, hey, these people are trying to buy tickets. They're trying to follow and be fans of your team. The last thing they want to worry about is if their player is going to be at the game that they spent $300 for. And if they're not going to go, that seems like a terrible way to find out moments before puck drop. Oh yeah, Elias Pettersson's not playing tonight. Thanks for your money though. Enjoy the game. You know, that's a terrible feeling.
Yeah, I completely agree with that point. It's sad that it's probably betting that's going to force the hand of the NHL, but yeah, there's a conservative hockey, you know, good old hockey man mentality of team first kind of image. And yeah, and in general, the NHL does a bad job of marketing and protecting its stars. So it's no shock really that they have this attitude, but yeah, it might be sports betting that kind of finds a way. I don't know if it's because the UK is so small, but just you can't get away with people find out stuff. Like people are either going to training grounds or, you know, a player will text his mate that he's injured and it'll be end up on Twitter. there's maybe just more leaks in football, but
well, I mean, arguably, many of the training grounds are set up in such a way that, you know, random person can actually observe practice, not in all instances, but like the NHL, I can't just go down to Rogers Arena and say, I'd like to watch practice in non-pandemic times. That's just not going to happen. And even when you have, you know, someone like Brendan Batchelor, who's there watching practice, who's tweeting out the lines, has his disclaimer, these are the lines as I've seen them. They are not an indication of the actual right. lineup. It is simply in order that they show up. You still have people like, well, what's going on? Like, why are there two defensemen skating on the right wing for the fourth line? And why is Sutter sitting watching practice in civvies? Is it a maintenance day? Is it a rest day? Is he, you know, is it a knock? Is it there's so many questions that are left unanswered. And then, oh, well, Sutter's playing. So I guess maybe he forgot his skates that day. Who knows? It's just, it's so surreal. Just on that note with practicing, though, I mean, one of the reasons why the practice take place is because even the greatest hockey players, they never quit practicing their skills to improve their game. And you shouldn't be any different. The ICBA trains thousands of workers every year on everything from Excel spreadsheets to excavating trenches, from personal leadership skills to construction estimating, from fall protection to effective management skills, and 500 other courses. They have them online. They have them on demand. They've got webinars and even COVID safe in person. ICBA has an option for you and your busy lifestyle. Start climbing the corporate depth chart by sharpening your skills today. Check out icba.ca/courses.
Take hitting out of the game. You can't hit anymore, so don't do it.
The unsportsmanlike conduct, I want to get an explanation on that.
No kidding.
Because how do you get suspended for unsportsmanlike conduct?
Plus interference. There's no interference there. He had the puck.
Now, Madison never ever did that before. Now, why did he do it? And that? Because he was mad.
Well, your early favorite for the Calder Trophy, that's for sure. Elias Pettersson, you might even say your early favorite for the Hart Trophy.
Just to get back to your question, Elias is going to play plenty. He's going to play. He's going to get a lot of power play time. And, yeah, I'm concerned about our offense. We lost 200-point players, and we've got to find a way to score.
So as we look at the Vancouver Canucks week ahead, they're in Ottawa for another game, this one on Wednesday. Now, Canucks.com says it's a 4 p.m. Pacific puck drop. If you're watching Sportsnet tonight, they told you it was 3:30. I'm going to guess that's Sportsnet trying to get you to tune in at 3:30 to watch the pregame, not the actual puck drop. So, you know, buyer beware. And then they head further east. I had to do my geography in my head there for a brief moment to play the Canadiens twice, both on Friday and Saturday in a back-to-back before coming home to face the Jets, which we'll obviously talk about in next week's show. The Vancouver Canucks tonight beat the Sens and have remained a good team against the Senators. Do we foresee them getting another 2 points against Ottawa on Wednesday, or are all things up in the air considering how the Canucks have been playing and the fact that the Senators seem to just win games against really good teams at random?
I think the Senators might actually pull this one out on Wednesday night. Demko is probably tired. I think he's tired every single day now moving forward. There's like Anna was saying, like that's what you get when 60 shots against every night. And look, the Senators team, they have nothing to lose, right? They are playing for pride. And for some of these guys, they might be playing for a job next season, but ultimately most of us agree the Senators are still in a rebuild mode. And these are just young players learning the game, having fun, trying to just score nice goals. And if the Senators lose a game, nobody really blinks an eye. So they go out there with not a lot of pressure. This Canucks team, far more desperate. We know they still would love to be a playoff team. We know that they're still without Elias Pettersson. We know they give up a lot of shots. And the Senators were awfully close to actually winning this game. So I do think the Senators, whatever it is, maybe that water and Eugene Melnyk supplying whatever, I don't know. Again, I can't explain it. The Senators, I just get this feeling. Call it an intuition. I think the Senators win on Wednesday night.
Yeah, I mean, we kind of joked a lot between Canucks sweeping the Sens in three games in a row, and now that everyone else seemed to be losing to the Senators, Ottawa's finding ways to win against all these other teams that Canucks couldn't beat. So I think we kind of approached this series with somewhat trepidation. And yeah, as you said, Canucks got awfully close to losing this game tonight. And as you say, Vetchedemko's pretty tired. We were talking about this in our pre-game live stream, and I'd be curious to get your thoughts, John, about where you rest your goalie. Do you rest him in one of the back-to-backs, or do you rest him Wednesday and then just say, we have no travel, you can do back-to-back Friday, Saturday?
Yeah, it was interesting, too, hearing John and John's thoughts about this during the game in the broadcast. I think I would probably, was it Shorty that said that he would, well, I guess Shorty made that statement, like, I'm not advocating for it, but mm-hmm. I would actually play Demko back-to-back Friday, Saturday, play Holtby Wednesday night against the Senators. I think Holtby needs a break as well. Not saying the Senators aren't challenging, like I just explained, mm-hmm. but if Braden Holtby is going to have a chance at picking up another win here, and I think he would love more wins right now to his Canucks resume, the Senators are still on paper the easier challenge than mm-hmm. one of those two Canadians nights on Friday and Saturday. So I play Holtby Wednesday. I go Demko back-to-back Friday, Saturday. As Cheech was saying, there's no travel. Same hotel, same city, same rink. It's all good. So I trust Cheech in the sense that he's a former NHL goaltender. And I say roll the dice and ride your number one, not 1A, your number one in Demko against the top team in the topper team in the Montreal Canadiens.
So the way I look at that, and I mean, the logic that you've provided is quite sound. The Vancouver Canucks are chasing wins against the Habs. I mean, obviously they need to win against the Sens too. They can't afford to lose against a team behind them, but they can't afford to give these sort of 4-point games, seeing it's divisional, to the Habs, who already have games in hand and already have, just looking at the standings just quickly here, 3 points with 5 games in hand. So, you know, if you were to consider the Vancouver Canucks, let's say they were to lose one of those two, it hurts. They lose both, even worse. But the counter to this is that statistically speaking, a goaltender who starts back-to-back craters in the second game, and I need to give a hat tip to Jay and C4, who's going to accuse me of stealing this idea, even though it's pretty universally accepted. Wouldn't arguments suggest that statistically speaking, while he is your number one goaltender and you're trying to get those wins, the odds are already against Demko? Like I'm not Travis Green, and I'm glad I'm not Travis Green in this situation, because it seems to me that it's a real tough call either way. I also like the idea of giving Holtby confidence and potentially getting him a win in Ottawa, because it's not a Holtby thing here. I really feel the Vancouver Canucks are hard pressed going to Montreal to get a win, let alone two.
Yeah, I think it's a really fair point. History has shown, and the numbers and the stats all support splitting a back-to-back game with your 1-1B or whatever your backup. I guess I just fall back on the playoff performance that Demko had. And mm-hmm. in one of those games, it was also back-to-back, and he was brilliant yet again. And there's no difference between the playoff bubble and going to Montreal and playing back-to-back nights. As Cheech is saying, no travel. You're going to the same hotel. You're going to be in the same routine. You're going to have the same pregame meal. There's some consistency there that maybe this isn't as big of a deal in this particular case. Now, if there was, say, the Montreal Canadiens on Friday and then the Toronto Maple Leafs on Saturday, even mm-hmm. though it's not that far of a travel schedule, I'd still at that point say, okay, we play the backup on the second game because we just can't do that. But because it's such a unique situation where it's the same team and you're in the same city, you just kind of go to bed and you say, all right, I'll just put that one behind me. Time to focus on the next day. And most hockey players that I've had conversations with, they just want to go back and play, you know, and especially goaltenders. If you find that a goaltender is in a groove and it seems like Thatcher Demko is in a groove, maybe the last thing you want to do is bench him, even if it is a back-to-back. Given the opportunity to play, and if it doesn't look good early on, sure, you can give him the hook at that point. But I would rather, I guess, fall on the sword with my gut instinct and your number one guy than doubt it and possibly, you know, miss out on the best chance to win that particular series.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I was just going to say that I think 9 times out of 10, unless there's some issue or really inexperienced backup, you split that back to back. But as you say, it's a strange situation. And if there's a way to find out, I mean, I'm reluctant to test Demko's limits when we still have, 25 games left. And you don't want to run him into the ground. But yeah, I am slightly curious to see if he can perform on back-to-back nights. Because, yeah, I do think he gives us the best chance of winning in Montreal.
Well, we can't get into Travis Green's head. I can presume he listens to the show. I mean, pretty much the entire team listens to C4 as far as I'm concerned. We saw just a couple weeks back a similar situation when the Vancouver Canucks were taking on the Winnipeg Jets. And you had Demko pitch a shutout, which usually under the pretext you ride your hot hand, a goaltender who pitches a shutout would generally start the next game, even if it was a back-to-back. He didn't. Holtby came in, and while you could probably suggest Holtby needed to stop a couple of those pucks, the team in front of him did not show up. Probably didn't matter if it was Demko or Holtby, the Canucks take an L there. Do you think that reinforces the belief that you got to ride Demko back-to-back, or do you think Travis sort of uses that as the example of, well, the team doesn't show up in game two. Do I really want to risk hurting, you know, our meal ticket in net? I mean, it is clear Demko's the number one. And while Holtby could maybe find his game again, you know, he's sort of misplaced a little bit. The team is arguably needing to do everything they can to remain healthy to make a run, to get to the playoffs, to in turn, once there, do something.
I think it's a really fascinating, it's a great example because, you know, Travis Green at that point already made that decision, back-to-back game. And again, no travel included, right? It's a good example. I guess I just feel like it's a little different for me personally because the Canucks did shut out the Jets that night. And I mean, all the credit goes to Thatcher Demko, but maybe there was a belief like, okay, you know what? The Jets aren't the Canadiens and they're not the Maple Leafs. On the standings, they're doing a lot better than the Vancouver Canucks. However, if you felt that the performance was as thorough as you got that night, which I believe was at the beginning of the month, then maybe you just say, okay, we'll go with Holtby in the second game of this back-to-back because we played so well as a team, like an overall unit. We had performances that we should be proud of up and down the list. It wasn't just on Braden Holtby. Whereas we know in more recent games against the Montreal Canadiens, finding even a single positive is so difficult to do. So you need every chance you can win, every chance you can be competitive in that game. And we are seeing that, and I'll just put this out there, your team MVP in Thatcher Demko going up against the Canadiens and specifically going up against Tyler Toffoli, he needs to be that guy for me.
Yeah.
I'm also of the opinion that it was a different situation because I'll admit I was pro Holtby starting against that second game. I was worried about burnout on Demko's end. And yeah, they were going into two games in 3 days against the Leafs without their star player. So I do think it's a slightly different situation.
So is it safe to say if Holtby starts Wednesday, that's a sign of back-to-back? Or if Demko starts, like, is it possible that if Demko starts Wednesday, he starts both games in Montreal? Like, Holtby has to get a game here, right?
You can't
start Demko all three games.
I mean, Calgary tried to do that with Markey.
Yeah,
look how that worked.
Exactly. Yeah, well,
Canucks learned that lesson as well. It's just apparently Calgary hadn't been watching the tape. You know, Calgary signs all former Vancouver Canucks without watching their durability over the previous seasons when you try to run them into the ground. I'm going to put you on the spot here. Three games, Ottawa, Montreal, Montreal. How many points the Canucks taken out of those three?
Three.
Okay.
I was going to say three.
Are you saying two out of Ottawa? Or are you saying one out of Ottawa? Or are you saying three out of...
No, I think you lose straight up in regulation against the Senators. Okay. Sorry, Braden. This is the game I start you in, and you're going to lose. I'm sorry about that. And I think you managed to get, you know, one win in regulation or overtime against the Canadiens, and then an overtime or shootout loss against the Canadiens. They are good. And they just seem to play the Canucks really well. So if I'm wrong and they even manage to get 4 points, I'll be impressed. Okay. I'll put it that way.
And Anna?
I was also going to say 3. I mean, I can see Sens as a banana skin team for sure. But if I had to predict, I'm going to say they win on Wednesday and take an overtime loss and a regulation loss against the Habs. So I'm going doom and gloom in Montreal.
See, I was much more pessimistic. I was giving the Vancouver Canucks 2 points, a loser point out of Ottawa and a loser point out of one of the Montreal games.
Honestly, and it's fair.
Right. Yeah. And at some point in time, especially after watching what just took place tonight, the Senators are going to get a win against the Vancouver Canucks. It is inevitable. It will occur at some point. And then considering Montreal has had Vancouver's number, when Vancouver gets wins against Montreal, it's not in regulation. And those are games where it could have gone either way. So I just don't have confidence, especially with, Pettersson remaining out of the lineup, the fact that the Canucks are still giving up, an epic number of shots to the, competition. There's just too many things playing against them, which for those of you who are optimistic and listen to this podcast, you should already be used to me occasionally taking the pessimistic approach. Before we dive into the F word, I wanted to get some thoughts here on some restricted free agents from you, John. So the reason this came up had everything to do, as I said, with the realization that Thatcher Demko is a restricted free agent with arbitration rights. I had somehow in my mind convinced myself his deal was not up this year, that it was up next year. And what I find quite interesting about this is that there has been a ton of conversation. How do you pay Petey? How do you pay Hughes? To some respect, are you keeping Gaudette and are you paying him? And then only recently, the Demko conversation struck up, and I think that has to do with Elliot Friedman saying there hasn't apparently been a whole lot of conversation between the Vancouver Canucks and the Demko camp, which I would suggest is a concerning aspect of negotiations, considering where we are in the season. But then, as we've also heard, Jim tends to find things move a little bit slower, and he sometimes runs out of time. So when we look at the RFAs, obviously, Petey, Hughes coming back, Demko obviously coming back. There, everyone gets qualified or ultimately paid. But what's it going to look like for the Canucks? Are you thinking that Demko is going to get himself a bridge? Because he's the one who's going to get to the unrestricted free agency quicker.
Yeah, I guess if of those three, I think Demko is the most likely to get a bridge. Mm-hmm. But I think ideally you want him for 4 years. And I would not. In a chance in hell, sign Pettersson and Hughes to a bridge. So again, if we fall back on what Benning was saying in his most recent appearance with the media, if you really believe this team is 2 years away from being legitimately contenders, why are you signing a bridge? Why are you making it so that you're going to have to pay these guys an enormous amount of money when this bridge deal is eventually over? And this is when theoretically you believe your window is just starting to open. That doesn't make sense to me. What you're trying to do is win every single season. But in being realistic, if you think that's 2 years away, have them locked up. Have them locked up because they're not even in the physical peak of their lives. And 2 years from now, they'll be that much stronger. They'll be that much more experienced in the NHL. I have no reason to suspect, based on the games that I've seen from Pettersson and Quinn Hughes, that they're all of a sudden going to take a step backwards in their development path. It's not linear, but it seems to be with these two. Mm-hmm. And so if you are doing a 3-year contract, that means in the first year of your competitive window, they're going to be hitting restricted free agency again. And they're going to have an enormous potential to command a lot and lot of money. So I don't know why you would want to do that. I stay away from bridge with those two. For Demko specifically, I looked at the Corey Schneider example from 8 years ago when he signed a 3-year, $12 million contract. And he was coming off a season in which he had 20 wins, 8 losses, 1 shootout loss. And his numbers were incredible, less than 2 goals against average and .936 save percentage. And he got 3 years, $12 million. To his point, Thatcher Demko has less games played than Corey Schneider will at this point in his career. But I do think because of his arbitration rights, the Canucks aren't going to have too much negotiating power. And given recent contracts for some of the goaltenders we've seen over the past year in the offseason, I would say that a fair value for Demko is anywhere from 3 to 4 years at $4 million per. And that would be kind of in the middle with what some people are saying, between $3.5 and $4.5 million every year.
Do you think his camp tries to go with the Binnington comparison, who just pulled 6 years angrily out of the St. Louis Blues?
Yeah, he fought everybody in the room and then signed the contract himself. No, I don't think it's that easily to compare. Like, obviously, they both have some pretty tremendous playoff records, but one of them is a Stanley Cup champion and a Calder Trophy winner, right? And so you can't necessarily say the same. Oh, sorry, not a Calder Trophy winner, but he got the Stanley
thinks
Cup.
He should have won it.
Yeah, he thinks. Right. Yeah.
Pardon me, that's what it was.
He is.
That's what it was.
A Calder Trophy
and whereas... Whereas with Demko, his development and his entry into the NHL has been slow played, which I appreciate. Like, there's nothing wrong with being a starting goaltender and only getting your first full season at the age of like 23, 24. Like, that's okay to me. So if Demko's camp wants to use the Binnington example, good luck. I don't think it's that heavily applicable. But if you're his agent, you're certainly trying to get your client as much money as you can. I just think that the numbers probably fall closer to Tristan Jarry, right? Or again, looking at that Corey Schneider example, it's really quite shocking. If you pull up Corey Schneider's early career numbers and Thatcher Demko's career numbers, the amount of games that they spent in the AHL, pretty similar. The amount of like their save percentage career in the AHL, again, pretty similar. And the fact that both of them had brief appearances in the NHL before arriving as like that 1A, 1B guy and then eventually taking it, it's eerily similar. So for me, I think maybe history just repeats itself. 3-4 years, $4 million per.
So how do the Canucks afford all of this?
That's because the million, bajillion dollar question.
Right? Like, I mean, I was joking with a friend of mine over Benning wanting 2 more years. And he's like, how does he come to this number? I'm like, oh, that's just in 2 years' time, all of his mistakes, save for maybe Myers, depending on which side of the glass you sit, are sort of gone. But the problem is getting to that point. Like, you have money tied up. And while I know many will point out, oh, Sutter's coming off the books and Erickson's got one more, but maybe they'll get rid of him. Oh, Edler's money's coming off the books, though you have to replace Edler. Like there's, I don't see the Vancouver Canucks in an advantageous situation where they can actually afford to pay Demko, Pettersson, and Hughes. And then put together a competitive team around these players, unless you're banking on Hoglander to continue to play the way he has, Podkolzin finding his way into the lineup and, you know, being next season's hog. Like, it's almost as if right now the Vancouver Canucks roster over the next 2 years to get to the, you know, the gym window is requiring all the what ifs to cash out and those what ifs we haven't yet thought to think of. I again, million-dollar question. Maybe that's why we're not GMs. We just don't know how to cook the books like he does.
He's just banking. It's just the way this roster set up is banking on a lot of things to work out. And all the prospects at the moment are not in great places development-wise. Colin's playing in Utica. He is doing pretty well, but he has just switched to center. So that's going to take some time to rework that out. We've got a lot of our prospects sitting in the taxi squad, not playing. Yulevi,
both of which, those Rafferty, two are RFAs.
I mean, that's worrying. Like, Podkolzin, very promising, but in a dodgy situation, like, development-wise, not what Canucks would want. So, it's just banking on a lot of things going well in a very uncertain world, even outside of the COVID and everything else.
Yeah, I think this has to be the final year for Alex Edler, unless he wants to come back on a $2 million contract next year. You simply can't, I think he's having a good season, good bounce back season. But at some point, you need to make those hard decisions. And this is similar to Chris Tanev for me last year. I did not mind seeing him go if that was the money that was associated to him. And similarly with Alex Edler, if you want $5 million plus, hey, great job for being. Yeah, exactly. Great job on your Canucks career, but it's not happening here anymore. And similarly, I think Sutter is gone. You try and trade him. Tanner Pearson, you do not resign him. You try and trade him. That way, you've cleared up, in theory, close to $14 million just based on those three players alone. And then the Seattle expansion draft, which for me is a bit of an X factor. So depending on what the Canucks want to do, if you don't want to protect Nate Schmidt, I think he'd be an interesting option for the Kraken. And that's what, 5.5 around there off your books. Ideally, though, you just leave both Myers and Schmidt protected, and then the Kraken are hopefully taking Braden Holtby off your hands, and that's 4+.
Well, actually, having you mention this, we reached out to our friends down the I-5 or Highway 99, Sound of Hockey podcast, and I'd asked them, like, who do you have right now projected for the Kraken to take? They actually had Cole Lind, and their reasoning was that, again, they didn't see an option sort of on the blue line, or at least a palatable option. I'll talk about that in a moment. Holtby, unfortunately, has not done himself well, that if the Kraken wanted to take him, that they do that considering the other goaltenders that'll be available. And the fact that Holtby's expensive when it comes to the cash he's paid. His contract isn't bad, but he's getting like things $6 million next season in
it's backloaded
actual money, right? And then their logic had Virtanen getting protected over Lind, and therefore they felt Lind would be the one who's exposed. Where this sort of started to go askew, the Vancouver Canucks blue line, to meet the expansion draft exposure requirements, will likely have them either expose Schmidt or Myers. Like, one of them has to be left open, unless they bring back an Edler or bring in another player who meets the exposure requirements based on games played. I was of the thought that the Canucks would expose Myers. Why? Because chances are the Kraken won't take him, so it's almost the safe exposure. But two, if they do, they just took a real hefty contract off of your books. Yes, you have to go and find another player to fill that role, but considering the role Myers has filled since he's joined the Canucks, I'm not entirely sure you have to pay that level of money to get it.
I can buy into that. Yeah, I think I can buy into that because, I mean, it's a win-win. Like, if they don't take Myers, great, you still got Myers. And if they do take Myers, you basically have a breath of fresh air because you're like, oh, my goodness. Oh, that sweet cap relief. I haven't had this in years. And you run with it. So I could definitely see that being a realistic scenario.
Yeah, I think that's what we were leaning towards. It would just be, and from the Myers perspective, you know, they're not going to take him. I would be happy if they do, but they're not going to.
But like, then again, it comes back to like what the Golden Knights did. And you can trade. Now, nobody wants to hear this, but you can make it so that Seattle will take Myers or Holtby and will give you X, whatever that X is.
Right.
Like, that's what scares people. It's like, don't let there be an X. But if it's like a third round pick, I don't mind if it means you're getting $6 million off the books.
Well, that's
sure. That's, anything above that does scare me because Canucks don't have much of X, whether that's cap flexibility or picks, you know?
They just don't have a lot of the alphabet left. Forget X, you know, all the other letters. They don't have any of it.
Well,
and we talked about as well. I'm just going to summarize what you were saying, Chris, that we don't want to see Seattle then flip Myers for something else. You know, if there's a willing trade partner for Myers, then Canucks should do it, you know.
Yeah, like in our pre-show, I commented how is it possible that Seattle Kraken, you know, you think about the Golden Knights, they're playing 3D chess. Like, the Golden Knights had a relatively competitive roster, a ton of cap space, a bunch of picks. Like, they were really well set up. I don't think we're going to see the Seattle Kraken get that good of a deal because too many teams have now figured this out and don't want to be the team. They don't want to be Florida, essentially, you know, in what they give up. But my worry is that with the Vancouver Canucks, Jim Benning does not have the credibility in that space, at least that I've seen as a fan, that would suggest he'd be able to do that in a way that doesn't necessarily hurt the Canucks. And if it just simply needs to be you expose a player and you lose maybe a decent prospect, I would rather that be it than, let's say, oh, let's incent you to take this contract we weren't too big on. We want you to take Louis Erickson. Thank you so much for taking Louis. Here are all the sweeteners we attach to it. And then suddenly you're like, well, wait a minute. We just gave away that for Louis. Like that, you know, that's the concern I have. We're going to talk more about on Jim Benning and his tenure as a GM in the F word. You're listening to the C4 Canucks Hockey Podcast on the Full Press Coverage Network and CanucksHockeyBlog.com.
He liked to say the F word.
Oh, then get the f*** here then. Okay, see ya.
F*** off. He's going to have the F word on it. I wish I could give you an explanation about it. I can't.
You out of hand.
You said the F word, Dad.
You called me the F word.
I went through this exercise last week, again, based on that conversation that I had had with probably not friend of the show, Caleb. I don't think he listens, or she. And I shouldn't presume it's a he. I'm just making the assumption based on the Twitter profile and the name. But I shared out a couple of graphics that I just whipped together because I started going down sort of memory lane, looking at the history of Canucks general managers and the performance based on seasons and playoff performances. There's actually two different graphics that we tweeted out at the C4 podcast. The first one just gives you total seasons and the total playoff appearances. And the reason I did this is I grew up watching the Vancouver Canucks in the 80s, which had some what I would have considered very seriously dark times. And then obviously that period in the 90s that often either gets referred to as the Keenan era or the Messier era or the they who shall not be named era. But what became very striking was that these teams, even in these dark periods of time, somehow found ways to make the playoffs from time to time. And if you look over the trend sort of year over year over year, there's really been only one GM who's had a good run with the team whose team made less than 50% of the season in the playoffs. Now, there are a couple zeros in there. Bud Poile in the first few seasons as Canucks GM didn't have a good go. Hal Lako only had a season, didn't have a good go. Mike Keenan was an actual GM, but he was acting during the period of time. His team didn't make the playoffs. But the closest comparison is Dave Nonis, who had four seasons at the helm. His team made the playoffs once, and eventually he was let go. Mike Gillis comes in. Mike had a number of seasons with the Vancouver Canucks, and his team missed the playoffs only once. And that season, he got let go. So how is it someone like Jim Benning, who is on currently year seven of his tenure with the Vancouver Canucks, his teams have made the playoffs twice, and one might even suggest one of those seasons is the asterisk because the Canucks got into the playoffs based on the pandemic, got healthy, and were able to get past a Jets team before moving on. Is this the darkest tenure in Canucks history?
Yeah, I think the numbers speak for themselves. It's hard to argue against the fact that this team hasn't been good for a long time. And I don't necessarily blame it all on Jim Benning. But I do think we can clearly see from day one when he got hired to where we are today, there has been like two or three different plans, and these plans do not work seamlessly together. So go back to the time when he was hired in 2014, it was clear the Canucks were slowing down. Mm-hmm. They weren't terrible. They weren't like, you know, the jokes of the NHL, but the Sedins were getting past their prime. They were old. They were getting older. You had a question mark in goal. You weren't really sure what you had for the prospect cupboard that was stripped bare. And stripped bare, but I say that as respectfully as I can, because during the Gillis era, when you were trying to win and be competitive each and every year, and you had an historically good team with that back-to-back President's Trophy wins, you know, you paid the price. You mortgaged the future to win now. I get it. But Jim Benning inherited that. And so it's like a mix of the ending result of what Mike Gillis was able to do with those fantastic numbers and that, you know, incredible percentage of getting to the playoffs. But then Jim Benning could have made things easier for himself if he identified right away that this team wouldn't be good. Instead, you know, as soon as he got hired, he was talking about how we need to bring more, you know, Canadian hockey into this team. We need to bring a bit more toughness, which is why you go and get Jake Virtanen instead of Nick Ehlers, et cetera, et cetera. David Pastrnak, the list goes on. If you had managed to identify right away that this team isn't going to be good for a few years, you could have done yourself a huge favor by cutting losses, trading away assets, and then mortgaging the future faster. Now, ultimately, that means you might not end up with Pettersson in the present day. So is it all worth it? Maybe. But history has shown that the numbers are just, I mean, they stand out. 7 years and 1.5 playoff appearances, because you're right, that play-in with the bubble, it can't fully count based on how we look back in the history books.
The thing about the Jim Benning tenure, and you raise a real good point. When he came in, he was likely tasked with a much different job than his predecessor in Mike Gillis. Mike Gillis was told to win. And once it became apparent that that was maybe not going to occur, for one reason or another, ownership decided a change was needed. I find this interesting. A number of reasons why. One, the Tortorella era, which was an interesting starburst, one might suggest it, was the, I think, last gasp at a closing window. But even Tortorella himself said, this team is stale, this team is slow. Mike Gillis, prior to his dismissal, said, you know, this, we need to go in and rebuild. Like, he wasn't talking about necessarily retool. We need to go sort of get down to the studs, build it back up. Ownership decides, you're not the guy that we want to do it. They bring in Trevor Linden. Trevor goes and reassesses the situation, finds that he brings in Jim Benning. And in that point in time, that's when the retool was introduced into the conversation. One of the things that Benny will often go back to is, well, I had the Sedins. I couldn't go and rebuild with them. It would have been fair to them. And as a Canucks fan, I can appreciate you treating Daniel and Henrik with respect, but your job is to make the tough decisions, these hard decisions. And what's not to suggest that the Vancouver Canucks, you know, don't find a way to go and recover, rebuild. I'll use the Toronto Maple Leafs as a comparable. The Toronto Maple Leafs, about the same time, decided they needed to go and rebuild. And what did they do? They weaponized their cap space. They started to go in and bring in draft picks. And then with the weaponized cap space and suddenly all this cap room, they go out and make a big signing, bringing a player like Tavares. Leafs haven't won a Stanley Cup yet, but based on the way this season's going, this is probably the closest they've been to that level of potential in a long time. The Vancouver Canucks feel they've regressed. If we consider last season progressive, this season is regressive, and going into a flat cap era and what have you, I don't see how Jim can say, oh, in 2 years, we're going to be competitive, because that would then dictate that when he said 7 years ago, this team will turn around in 5 years. That means during those first five prior to the pandemic, something went askew. And either one, he can't go and tell us what it is because he's not too sure, or two, things went askew. I'm going to blame the pandemic without maybe doing the math. Because, you know, here at C4, we don't do math well either. So I'll give Jim a pass. But like, that's the struggle I have, is I just don't understand how he is continuing to get as much time as he is getting. When as a fan, I can't even tell you, you know, all the different reasons. I mean, we talked about this on my previous shows. When the leader of your organization comes out and says, I live day to day, I look at things day to day, that's the most hockey cliche ever. But I can't think of a senior leader of an organization in business that even considers the day to day. They're already thinking 3 months ahead. They're thinking quarter to quarter.
What I find interesting is in both of what you guys have said, there's been about three or four examples of the damage done by the myth that Canucks lost the cup to Boston because they weren't tough enough. And just when you look at that series, the reffing was so bad. I won't dig too deep into tinfoil hat stuff there with, you know, like Suns on the team and stuff, but you know, the reffing was so bad and Canucks just didn't perform in some key games there. And just the Canucks spent years and years chasing after this toughness, this Canadian grit over European skill or whatever however Brian Burke put it. And yeah, I'm not going to, you know, absolve Jim Benning in that. Like, there's lots of decisions. It's not like he was brought in to do the meat and potatoes job and constructed a meat and potatoes roster, but yeah, he's had 7 years. Like any person in that job, like whatever you were told to do, this wasn't it. And the lack of planning, you can't plan for a global pandemic. I can understand that, but having zero flexibility so you're backed into a corner by it is another thing.
And Chris, I think you made some excellent points. Look at John Tortorella and look at Mike Gillis's leaving, sort of departing comments, is that this team needs to rebuild. We need to strip it down. It's not working, too slow. It's just not good enough. Both of them dismissed shortly after making such comments. What happens with Jim Benning? He never once admits that this team needs to rebuild. What happens with Trevor Linden? Admits that this team needs more years because we need to continue to invest in a rebuild. Trevor Linden has a, what were they calling it? A mutual
pardon? Yeah, the separation or departure, agreed upon departure.
Yes, see, like I've tried to even just suppress that part of my memory because that's kind of been another example of why this is the darkest timeline. Yeah. It seems like there's a trend where if you speak out against wanting to stick with winning now, you're not welcome with this Canucks organization anymore. And that's not even Jim Benning making that say. That's coming from ownership.
Yeah.
And so it just feels like the reason why Jim has been able to stay around as long as he has, despite not really having much to show for it, is because he tells ownership what they want to hear. He tells them, yeah, you think we can win now? Let's win now. Sure. And then the next day when he'll be like, oh, we might need to win next year. I hope that's okay. We'll win next year. I promise we'll win next year. And then next year rolls around and he says, we might need a couple more years, but I promise you we're going to win. I promise you I'm the right guy for this. Yeah. So if you tell the people that are in charge of your employment what they want to hear, chances are you're going to find a way to stay in that job, stay in that role. And if you tell them the uncomfortable truths like Trevor Linden, like, you know, Mike Gillis and John Tortorella, you don't stick around. So clearly that's a bit of a pattern that needs observation, because I think that speaks volumes as to why we're now entering possibly year 8 of Jim Benning as a general manager of this team.
Yeah.
And I just want to add, because I do have a reputation for being negative, that personally for me, this is not even my darkest timeline as a fan. I've been a fan only since 2011 and I'm not getting up at 3 a.m. to watch Canucks lose. And I have a great Canucks podcast with a fun co-host, and I get to like trash talk on Canucks Twitter, and I get to watch most of the time Pedersen and Hughes. So like, as a fan, it's not my darkest timeline, but as an organization, I can totally see it is.
Fair.
Yeah, I think, you know, just sort of to wrap this up, the reason I asked that question is that despite even I think fans accepting rebuild, I won't suggest that Vancouver Canucks fans would have accepted a long-term rebuild. They might have given the Vancouver Canucks a year or two to fully on embrace the blow everything up. Now that we're told the rebuild is done, I think my expectations are not inadequate when I suggest that done means you're in the playoffs, you're in playoff contention, you're not X number games below 500 where you can't defensively stop pucks. Like the Vancouver Canucks, and I've referred to this in previous shows, they feel a lot like the 80s Oilers. We're going to score more goals than the other team does, and Grant Fuhr is going to get us that one save we need to win the game 9-8. That's not good hockey. Well, I'd love that high event hockey. That's not good hockey in the modern era. So I'm reaching this point where I don't know how much more I can take. And maybe if I'm honest with myself, it doesn't really matter. I'm going to continue to be a Vancouver Canucks fan regardless. I'm just going to get maybe angrier about it.
More jaded.
Yeah. Well, can you be? I mean, I'm pretty jaded. I've been around here for quite some time. You know, as we sort of, you know, look to wrap things up, I'm genuinely curious what you, our listeners, think about the current tenure of Vancouver Canucks. Is it the darkest timeline? I'll share a link to the graphic in our show notes. It'll be on our weekly newsletter as well. How do you let us know? Well, first and foremost, you can jump into C4 Discord, discord.io/C4podcast. You can tell us real time. Alternatively, you can drop us a text message. The C4 text line, 604-200-6201, 604-200-6201. And I share that because we got a text message in, some feedback from our last show. Let me share that. It's actually a follow-up based on something Anna had said regarding Jim's ability to go in and make phone calls. Rich, friend of the show, said, just legit bark laughed at Anna's line about Cesco giving Jim a Fisher-Price phone to play with. Beauty.
That's safer.
I was going to say, do you think Jim would notice the difference? But that's mean. And I shouldn't be mean-spirited like that. But I have one. Baby Force, if I were to move, she doesn't know. I can't remove it in sight because Baby Force has applied ownership to everything and anything. So it can't leave. But if she doesn't know it's missing and I donate it to Jim, C4 can help out.
Hey, instead of a Fisher-Price phone, maybe we should be getting Jim some kind of timepiece, because he seems to struggle with timekeeping. So
a nice Timex wristwatch. We can't afford that. Maybe a Casio.
I was going to suggest like something way cheaper. What are those kids watches you get? Flick Flack or something?
It's been a while. Used to get them in like those little vending machines, I think. I don't
oh,
know.
Oh, yeah. Like almost well, like
there's, there's vending machine stoppers. Watches. That's what I'm thinking of. Yeah, that's
yeah.
Right.
Yeah. Let's
and
do it.
It only costs a quarter. I mean, the podcast could afford that. I could pony up pony up the cash. But if you want to let your thoughts be known, again, C4 text line 604-200-621. You can also leave a voicemail if you'd like. If you drop us a voicemail, it makes it a whole lot easier to play your words in your words on the show as opposed to me reading them out. And the newsletter I referred to earlier, the easiest way to find it is bit.ly/the C4 newsletter. That's bit.ly/the C4 newsletter. Each week, Friday morning, we'll shoot out a quick note. Either myself or Anna will put together sharing this last week's news, any sneak peeks and previews of upcoming shows. For instance, everyone who subscribed to the newsletter knew John was going to be joining us. We didn't actually share that news until last week, but newsletter people learned 2 weeks ago. So there's always reasons why you want to subscribe. But John, again, thank you so much for joining us. Hopefully we didn't scare you away. And that note, when you join us as a guest, you become friend of the show, which means you're always invited to join us again and come back.
Yeah, I loved it. Anna, Chris, thank you for having me. This was fun. Not only did I enjoy this, but as the new friend of the show, I look forward to my invitation back. And who knows, maybe this whole world will be a little bit better, a little safer, and we'll be able to get beers and things like that. Okay, well, Chris and I will get beers. Anna, we'll toast in your honor.
No, I want the pub so much. I miss it.
You know what? Here's the idea. Next C4 live show, when we can actually have live shows again, John's going to be there as a guest. We'll have beers and podcast at the same time.
I'm in.
Sounds great. Good. John, where can all of our listeners find you if they haven't already found you to give you their words about all your hot takes?
Oh, yeah. I love getting that. Nothing like hate mail and fan mail every now and then. You can find me on Twitter at John Jang, spelled JawnJang. And again, I'm always on CKNW as an on-air contributor and host. So find me at 980.
Awesome. So again, John, thanks for tuning in or joining us. And thanks to all of our listeners for tuning in. Let us know your thoughts on the show, all the feedback, C4 Discord, as I said earlier, discord.io/C4podcast. And you can find all of our episodes at c4podcast.com. So on behalf of myself, Chris at Lightforce, Anna Forsyth at A4Sight03, thank you for tuning in to the C4 Canucks Hockey Podcast, the longest running and best mediocre Canucks podcast out there. By the way, we're out.